Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning in. My name is Duke Machado, and you are listening to the Duke Machado Show. Tonight we have a special guest, Congressman Bill Flores. He joins us. He's calling in to the studio, and we're going to talk about the omnibus, the power of the purse. We're talking about ISIS, and guess what? He's got a couple of primary challengers in this upcoming election, so we're going to talk just a little bit about the campaign. And how you doing, Congressman?
I'm doing great, Duke. I hope all of our listeners had a great Christmas and that 2016 turns out the way we hope it will.
Yeah, and, the future, we've had a talk about this before. The future doesn't look so bright a lot of times, and you wake up and you just read the news, and it's so depressing. And, for those of us, when Barack Obama was elected, we kind of entered a depression and have not come out. And that's not just a mental depression, but a financial depression, too. And, we're hoping that our elected officials, you and others, your colleagues, can somehow pull things together and truly turn this ship around. Tell me how you see things. What's the pulse in Washington right now?
Well, 2015 was a pretty challenging year, as I think most of our listeners are aware. We went into the year full of high ambitions because we thought that given the fact that we had great control of the House and that we had conservative control of the Senate, that we'd be able to get a lot done. But we flew in the face of the filibuster rules in the Senate, and so you've got this 18th century rule that's not written anywhere in the Constitution that made it very difficult for us to be able to advance the things that in the Senate that were being advanced in the House. And so, unfortunately, even though we had a very strong agenda, we weren't able to fulfill that agenda the way we had hoped to because Harry Reid and the minority and the we wanted to do. That said, we did get some good things done during the course of the year. We passed the first Medicare reform in a couple of decades. When we were able to reform the sustainable growth rate, or the SGR, as it's known in the medical community. We also put up a great vote on a Syrian refugee bill to change the way the refugees from Syria and some other Middle Eastern countries are vetted. That was a strong vote. For those people in the medical profession, we also had a meaningful use bill that passed late the week before last that helped that got the Center for Medicaid studies out of the hair of our doctors. Then the omnibus bill and the tax extender bill were the last two big things we did. Now, the tax extender bill was not as controversial because we were able to extend several key tax attributes that are important for small businesses. Bonus depreciation, Section 179, expensing, things like that, R&D credits for the companies. It's been a lot on R&D. Then in the omnibus bill, that was a mixture of good things and bad things, but the good things in the bill I thought were pretty compelling. Number one is we funded the Defense Department at a level that's $25 billion higher than what it was being funded under sequestration levels. And sequestration really hurt the military. And that had made it difficult for us to deal with the national security issues that we're having because of the president's failed foreign policies. Also, we were able to limit the 40-plus-year-old ban on the export of American oil, which is huge for the economy. Over time, that will help generate 1 million new jobs and $170 billion worth of extra GDP for the country. It's good for consumers and producers. Also, it's good for our balance of trade. It's good from a geopolitical standpoint because the bad actors in the Middle East and Russia have less in the way of revenues to cause disruptions around the world. So that was huge. It was a strong vote for Texas, I felt like. There were things in the bill that were also bad that people don't like. I didn't like them either. But there's also a lot of misinformation about what was in the bill, and we'll go through that in the course of this call. So we really got – also, the other thing we did, for the first time in 10 years, the House and the Senate each passed a joint budget, which will which balanced in less than 10 years. Now, again, a budget is not a document that's written into law. It's just something that sets the aspirations, that sets us up for what we could do if we could put the right person in the White House in 2016. So in terms of what I see in 2016, I think we'll take what we were able to do by getting some of these tougher issues resolved and behind us. Next year will be a very aspirational year. You'll see us put forth what our vision of conservative tax reform looks like, what it would look like to repeal and replace Obamacare with a patient-centered solution that believes in states' rights. You'll see those things. You'll probably see us put together our vision of what welfare reform looks like. And then we'll make another stab at trying to do the appropriations bills in a way that doesn't rely on an omnibus like we had in 2015. So hopefully we'll put up 12 appropriations bills instead of one big mega 2,000-page bill and be able to change what happened to spending, the way money is spent in Washington. So anyway, it was a mixed year. I mean, there were some bad things that happened this past year that I didn't like in 2015. The budget deal that was passed right as John Boehner was leaving the House of Representatives increased the debt ceiling, increased spending for defense, which I thought was okay, the defense spending, but then it also increased non-defense discretionary, and I didn't think that was appropriate at all. But that to me was not a good thing. But that's kind of a recap of the year. I'm looking forward to next year because I think we'll be able to put together a much more visionary legislative agenda than what we were able to do this past year.
Well, I do appreciate that breakdown, and it is always good to hear all the successes that you've had or that we've had. At the same time, I just can't help but think, I mean, like part of me feels, we know this, and it's just not in this district, but all across the country. When Obama was elected, we all responded and we said that we're going to send people to Congress to go stop this. And you were one
right.
of those people. I mean, people stood up. They
correct.
They finally volunteered their, you know, you put yourself out there and said, I'm going to do this. And it's a huge undertaking. And so, you know, you defeated an incumbent 20-year Democrat in this region. And so, you know, everyone's grateful for that. And we were told, we were all told, that kind of maybe it was just like damage control, but we all saw what Obama was planning. We knew he immediately went after the health care, and we were all thinking that we could stop it through funding. And
right.
we
right.
all had a peace, an inner peace about things where we say, well, it's okay, we've got control of the House, we're going to stop this. One of the things that is being circulated is that the omnibus completely funded Obamacare. Is that true?
And that's false.
Okay.
That's false. Yeah, and here's the deal. Unfortunately, back in 2013, there were some people that were selling a narrative that Obamacare could be defunded through the appropriations process. And that was only slightly true. It was predominantly false. And here's why. Obamacare has two principal funding sources. One is through a package of taxes and so forth that are go into a mandatory spending pot, which means that until you change the Obamacare law, that money goes in, is put into that bucket, and is spent for the benefits of Obamacare. That's mandatory spending. That cannot be changed through the annual appropriations process. Now, this is all inside baseball, but I'm trying to be totally illustrative of the way it really works. Now, the second part, the smaller part of the funding Obamacare, is the funding of the implementation. It's the funding of the bureaucrats at Health and Human Services, or HHS, as it's known in Washington,
mm-hmm.
that put the program in place. Now, when Obamacare was passed by the Democrats, right before Americans elected that big wave class that I came in with, the Democrats had planned to appropriate billions and billions of extra dollars on the discretionary side through the annual appropriations process to pay for all these bureaucrats to implement the law. And that has never been done. We have never given the president anywhere close to the amount of money that he wanted to be able to do that. As a matter of fact, if you look, we've actually cut most of the discretionary spending in the government to less than what it was in 2008, the last year of Democratic, the last year before the takeover of the House by Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've actually reduced it below that. So that's one of the reasons Obamacare's implementation has been spotty, is because we haven't fully funded it. Now, on the mandatory side, there were a few folks that tried to sell Americans on the fact that you could defund the mandatory side of Obamacare through the appropriations process. So that's just not the way the law works. That's not the way the budget appropriations process works in Washington. So that didn't happen. So it was impossible to do what some people were claiming to be done, could be done.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the challenges, is that a lot of people were sold a bill of goods by some people back in sort of 2012, 2013. But that said, we have defunded parts of it. Now, and this omnibus is the implementation of Obamacare being funded. Well, yes and no. You won't see anything in the actual omnibus bill that says you're funding Obamacare, but what you will see are line items to fund the Department of Health and Homeland Security,
mm-hmm.
Health and Human Services, HHS. And so that you'll see that funding to do that, and they're using some of that money to implement Obamacare. But again, two things. One is it's never anywhere close to what they wanted, and it's actually they've had reductions in their budget over the course of the past few years. So if anybody makes a claim that Obamacare was fully funded in the omnibus, that is absolutely false, because the president's desire, the Democrats' desire, was to have tens of billions of dollars of additional funding over and above what they're actually getting.
Well, if say a lot of American people were under the impression that we could have stopped it through funding, and that ultimately ends up being false. The people now, especially presidential candidates or anyone who is running on any sort of platform to repeal, replace, etc., Obamacare, is that also just being sold another bill of goods?
Well, not exactly. Well, yes and no, and part of it depends on the time. Here's what we're going to do. The House and the Senate have each passed reconciliation bills to remove substantial chunks of Obamacare and basically set it up where it will fall. It will fail because the internal underpinnings of the law are being ripped out. So it's like pulling key parts of the frame of a building out. Eventually the building is going to collapse. And so the House passed a reconciliation bill. I thought it was a little too light to get rid of Obamacare, but we passed it. And then the Senate really amazed me. They stepped up and passed an even stronger reconciliation bill that more aggressively goes after Obamacare than the House bill. That has passed the Senate. That will pass the House in early January. And by the way, there's a defund Planned Parenthood provision of that bill that the House will vote on. So that not only are we ripping out key parts of the infrastructure of Obamacare, but there is an absolute defunding of Planned Parenthood in that reconciliation bill. We'll vote on that around January the 6th. Now, here's the challenge, though. The president will veto that. Okay. The reason it passed the Senate is because it only required 51 votes under the reconciliation rules. Normal legislation, the Senate usually requires 60 votes. So the president is still going to veto it, and in order to override it, would have to have 67% of the House and Senate that would vote that way. We won't get that. So what does that mean? It means Obamacare stays in place for the rest of 2016, and depending on who the president is and who controls the House and Senate in 2017 determines whether or not we can actually have another stab at Obamacare in 2017. So again, here's what happens. The House will vote on reconciliation to get rid of big chunks of Obamacare. It'll go to the president. The president will veto it. We'll try to override it. We won't be successful in overriding it because we don't have two-thirds, because they're Democrats and still do whatever the president says. Then in 2017, if the Republicans get the White House, if they keep the Senate, and if we keep the House, we can use reconciliation again to try to do the same thing. And then we've got a lot higher likelihood that we could do something with Obamacare. But until then, you're going to have to rely on the pieces we pulled out. I mean, for instance, if you look at the omnibus and the tax extender package we just passed, we delayed two key tax revenues that were going to go into Obamacare. One was the medical device tax, and the other one was the Cadillac insurance plan tax, and also a tax on insurance companies. Those were all deferred for a couple of years, so that it makes the funding for Obamacare harder to raise. So again, that hurts the ability of Obamacare to do what the president wants it to do. So yes, we've heard it. Two, we'll make a strong statement in 2016 when we pass this reconciliation bill. But unless that we can win the White House and keep the Senate and the House in 2017, we're not going to, that's the only chance we've got to get rid of it. That's the reason 2017 election is so important, is we've got to have at least a simple majority in the Senate, and we've got to have the White House to have another shot at this.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break real quick. Those great insight on the omnibus. I do have a question real quick.
Sure.
The pro-life movement, or read an article or comment from Dr. Carson. Is or was Planned Parenthood funding allowed, or did we allow for funding of Planned Parenthood in this omnibus, or is that another rumor?
Well, no. Technically, no, but in effect, yes. Now, here's the way this works, and people have said we fully funded Planned Parenthood. That is absolutely false. If you look at the bill, all 2,000 pages of it, you won't find the words Planned Parenthood anywhere in that omnibus bill. Now, what happens is that there are allocations of money to different departments of the government, and Planned Parenthood applies for those grants, and the Obama administration gives them those grants, gives Planned Parenthood money to do the things to essentially kill babies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we had hoped to have in the omnibus is language that is explicitly says that no money can go to Planned Parenthood or to any other abortion provider. We did get some of that language, but it's not as aggressive as what many of us would have liked. But that said, the best chance that we have at defunding Planned Parenthood comes when we have the reconciliation bill for Obamacare on the floor of the House in January, because that's where Americans will see that we made a strong statement. Look, I've got a 100% pro-life voting record, and the pro-life groups that score those votes looked at they're smart enough to know that in the omnibus bill there was no funding for Planned Parenthood, but they also realized that some of the money is going to be allocated by the Obama administration. But they also realized that there was no way we could get all of the protections we wanted in the omnibus bill, because you still have a Senate that requires 60 votes to get anything done, and you got to have a president sign the appropriations bill if you want to keep the government open and fund the Defense Department at the levels it needs to be funded at. The number one thing I'm hearing from our constituents in District 17, and really all across Texas and all across the country, is national security is the most important issue on everybody's minds. And so the big thing was to fund Homeland Security, to fund the Defense Department, to close the loophole in the visa waiver program that allows people to get on planes in the morning, be here this evening, and start killing Americans. Those are things that they're more important, and that's the reason the pro-life groups didn't score the omnibus, because they know, A, it's not explicitly funded in there, and B, we're going to have a better stab at trying to stop it in January.
All right. Well,
by the way, there were good pro-life riders in the omnibus bill. I mean, the Hyde Amendment, things like that, which prevent the ability of federal dollars to be used for abortion. It's not 100%, but it's a lot stronger than we'd have had if you'd have Democrats in charge.
I'm sure of that. Well, we're going to come back right after the break. We're going to get into national security. I know that's on your mind, Congressman. We'll be right back after
one disease. Millions of lives permanently disrupted. Today, there are over 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's disease. But Alzheimer's is taking more than memories. It's taking lives. What few realize is that Alzheimer's kills more people than breast cancer and prostate cancer combined. And Alzheimer's is the only disease in the top 10 causes of death that can't be slowed, stopped, or prevented. From 2000 to 2013, while deaths from other diseases decreased significantly, Alzheimer's deaths increased 71%. But equally disturbing, many living with Alzheimer's say they are not being told their diagnosis. While more than 90% of people with the most common types of cancer say they are told their diagnosis, only 45% of people with Alzheimer's or their caregivers say they are told. The economic toll is staggering, too. In 2015, it will cost the nation $226 billion to care for people with Alzheimer's. By 2030, 72 million baby boomers will reach an age of greater risk. The fact is, everyone's at risk for Alzheimer's, even you. But everyone can help, especially you. We're the Alzheimer's Association, the brains behind saving yours. Join us.
Okay, folks, we're back, and still we have Congressman Flores on the line for another 10 minutes or so. So I want to get right back into this. You know, you mentioned right before the break that the number one focus on the constituents' mind is national security. Right now it's all about terrorists. It's all about ISIS. What are we doing? What are you doing to stop this invasion on American soil? What's the process? Is there a process?
Well, yes, we've done in the House three principal things. I mean, we've done dozens of things to deal with the Islamic terrorist threat to the United States. The first thing is we funded our Defense Department at a level that needed to be funded. That's the reason the omnibus bill was so important, because it had to improve funding levels for defense. The second thing is we funded Homeland Security at levels we should. And the third thing consists of two components. Number one is back right before Thanksgiving, we passed a bill out of the House to beef up the Syrian, the refugee. Let me say this. The United States has had a refugee program to allow refugees to come in from dozens of other countries around the world for decades. And it's done whenever there's a humanitarian crisis. We let these folks come to the United States. We could debate whether or not we should do that at another time. One of the things we were worried about is these Syrian refugees in the next 18 months or so could put us at risk, because the ones that are entering the pipeline now could be trying to exploit the refugee program that we have here in the United States and wind up coming here in 12 to 18 months and becoming a national security threat. So right before Thanksgiving, we passed a bill to halt that program until such time as the FBI, which is an apolitical part of the federal government, can vet these refugees to make sure that they don't represent a national security risk. The important thing about this is that this bill is going to be taken up by the Senate in January as well, and then it'll go to the president's desk. Hopefully the president will sign it. We had a veto-proof majority in the House that passed it. I think we'll have a veto-proof majority in the Senate that will pass it, and so hopefully the president will sign it, and we'll have the safeguards in place to prevent the Syrian refugee program from being a problem. Now, one of the things people complained about in the omnibus was that we fully funded that program. Now, that's not true. What we funded was a refugee program that we've been funding for decades. What people are upset about is we couldn't get the rules tightened inside the omnibus. I would have liked to have seen better rules, but we already had a bill that we'd passed that really was better suited to fix that. Anyway, the second part of this is that the biggest threat we have today from a terrorist standpoint here on our shores is that there are 38 countries in the world that participate in something called a visa waiver program. That means that a person can get on a plane, say in France, it could be a terrorist. They can have a French passport or somehow gotten a French passport, get on that plane, land in the United States today, and then start killing Americans in the near future. That was the biggest single security risk that we had. In the omnibus, we basically closed that program off to countries that don't adhere to certain standards. One is you've got to use e-passports like we use here in the United States. You've got to share the information with the other countries in the visa waiver program so everybody knows who's getting on some kind of an aircraft or a vessel to come to transit to another country. That was dramatically tightened the loophole that was a big security risk. So those are the big things we've done. Now, taking a step back and looking at the macro picture for a minute, if you look at what caused the ISIS situation to happen, one is the president didn't come up with a coherent foreign policy to deal with the civil war in Syria. As a matter of fact, he helped destabilize Syria because he decided that he was going to try to pick and choose among rebel groups that were fighting Assad, and that further destabilized Syria. Now, Assad is a bad guy, and we don't want to support him, but it's not necessarily appropriate to get involved in Syria and further destabilize it. If you think about what he did in Libya, we didn't have any problems with Libya, but he decided he wanted to go after Gaddafi, so he destabilized Libya, and suddenly we wound up with four dead Americans in the Benghazi attack. The other thing that he did is he withdrew from Iraq too early, and the president's naive because he thinks that if the United States pulls out of an area and leaves a vacuum, that everybody will just stay where they were and they'll all play nice together. Well, they didn't, and so the vacuum that was left in Iraq, along with how the president destabilized Syria, allowed ISIS to rise up. Now, what are we doing about it? Number one is Congress has appropriated more money to be able to use the air campaign to go after ISIS. The next thing we did is in the National Defense Authorization Act that we passed earlier this year, we told the president he's got to come up with a plan to deal with the rise of radical Islamic terrorism and ISIS. Once he does that, then we can pass an AUMF, an Authorization for Military Force, to back that up. We can't give him a blank AUMF because we don't know what the president will do with a blank AUMF. We want him to come up with a strategy to defeat them because that's his job as Commander-in-Chief. That's not Congress's job. I mean, we will advise, we'll assist, we'll give the money, and then we'll provide the authorities to do it, but he's got to show us what the plan is.
It's a funny thought, envisioning him trying to come. It's a funny thought, visioning him trying to come up with that plan. I mean, I don't think he's capable on his own, but then he has advisors. So,
well, I don't think he is either. If he uses Valerie Jarrett, for instance, mm-hmm. he's not going to get anywhere. But we still have the world's greatest military. And so I've been to Iraq once, I've been to Afghanistan three times now, and when I sit down with our military advisors, I'm convinced that if we ask them to give us a plan, and then turn them loose to execute that plan and give them the tools to do it, that they'll defeat ISIS. But the problem is the president's going around doing having press conferences with at the Pentagon, the national security team, and trying to act like he's interested in ISIS, but he's not carrying out what the commanders have told him needs to be done mm-hmm. in order to defeat this enemy. And I hope he does it before we have any more,
powerful
marathon type bombings or San Bernardinos or anything like that. The good news is we did close the biggest single domestic risk that we have, and that's the visa waiver program, and that was cured in the omnibus. And then we'll fix the Syrian refugee thing in a challenge in December. But again, that's not a challenge for at least 12 to 18 months down the road.
Hi, my name is Duke Machado, and I am the host of the Duke Machado Show. And tell you, I'm very excited to be joining the team at Patriot Insight. I invite you to listen to my program Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm a little different. I'm rational. We're going to have a rational discussion. I will take calls. We can have dialogue. I'm going to have guests, special guests, experts in their field. I interview congressmen, senators, and everyday Americans about today's toughest issues. So you're not going to want to miss the program. Tune in, spread the word. The Duke Machado Show is on Patriot Insight. You can follow me on Twitter at DukeMachado1 or find me on Facebook, The Duke Machado Show, now on Patriot Insight. Well, let me ask you, I've seen some news reports of different countries really cracking down on Islam. It seems like they're not allowing new mosque construction. They're outlawing or banning burqas. Is the United States heading to that sort of a policy towards Islam, you think?
Well, I don't know that we ought to be targeting Islam or targeting Muslims. I think what we need to be doing is targeting terrorists. And so I think that what we need to do is figure out what do we need to do to make sure that we are projecting power internationally, overseas, to keep these organizations from sprouting up and spreading like the president's allowed to happen on his watch. So number one is we project power overseas. Secondly, we have a very strong homeland security operation so that we capture these folks as they come into the country, or we're tracking them, and that we provide the resources to our intelligence gathering so that if you are a foreign person, I'm not talking about U.S. citizens, but if you're a foreign person in the United States, you know, if you're suspected of terrorism, then you can be watched. So I think, you know, we're going to have to figure out how do you profile a terrorist and watch those and stop, find those folks and stop their activities.
Yeah, how do you
again,
profile them without
US
being
citizens,
without profiling them?
Well, that's the challenge. That's the challenge. You can't say, okay, you're a Muslim, so you're automatically a terrorist, because there are peace-loving folks that practice Islam.
Yeah, there are definitely moderate Muslims. I've met a few of them. I know, they're not
and
crazy.
So what we've got to do is target. You know, the best thing to do is if the president had not allowed this, I mean, if he hadn't pulled out of Iraq too early and hadn't helped further destabilize Syria, we wouldn't be having this conversation today. And so what we've got to do is, heck, now, the last time we went to Afghanistan last November, we've got ISIS in Afghanistan now. Now, they're not a big threat right at this minute, but, you know, fortunately, the rules of engagement in Afghanistan are a little bit different, and so we have greater ability to stop them in their tracks versus let them spread like the president did in Iraq. But the best way to do it is to stop it from spreading overseas, and that way it never gets here to begin with. And that's the way we've got to define our foreign policy. It's got to be a lot more Reagan-esque, and that is we build the world's strongest military, and we do it because we want peace, because folks don't pick on the people, on the biggest kid on the block. And that's what
Yeah.
That's the way we need to look at this.
Yeah, you're right there. Well, I want to do this. We've only got a couple minutes left here. I know we're already over on time, but this is campaign season, and the deal is about the House is every couple years you're back on the ballot. This time you're opposed. You've got a few challengers on the primary ticket. Tell me, why do you think they're challenging you? What do you think the motivation is?
Well, I really don't know what the challenge is. What causes people to decide to run for office against other conservatives. Let me say this. Our Constitution says if you meet certain criteria, then you can run for office. And so I fully support our Constitution. And if people want to run against me, be they Republicans or conservatives or libertarians or independents, that's fine. I mean, that's how the political process works in this country. And so I'm not really sure. I mean, you and I both have a common friend who's running.
Who's
running against me.
Interesting, yeah.
And I'm not sure about that one. I have no clue. But that said, I've run several campaigns in the past. I know how to run campaigns. We'll run a campaign. We'll talk about our record.
Yeah. Well, you like to win, and you play to win. That's for sure.
Oh yeah. And if somebody distorts my record, we'll make sure that we set the record straight.
Right.
I mean, look, I according to the last time National Journal did a ranking, I was the 20th most conservative person in the House. And so for people to say that they can out-conservative me is a little bit of a stretch. I've got 100% Second Amendment voting record, 100% pro-life voting record, got strong constitutional voting records, as well as being a strong fiscal conservative. So
you know what I think
we just
it
have
is
to make sure everybody knows the truth.
You know what I think it is? It's like in the presidential election. Ben Carson, he's very logical, he's methodical, he's thoughtful. He's going to think of a problem. He's not going to react loudly. He's not going to react real quickly. For the most part, he's going to have a really good solution, but the one who gets all the accolades or gets all the attention is the one who's like Donald Trump or, just
uh-huh.
saying things. And I guess the question is it more important, or it's like, do people want a fighter, someone to storm the beaches, or do they want someone to map out a game plan and operate the plan? The plan may take longer, but it's going to work. Or do you take a chance on storming the beach and hoping that it works? It's an interesting dynamic. It's not just in this race, but it's in the presidential election. The different personalities.
Oh, it absolutely is. Oh, absolutely. I've got my biases as far as which presidential candidates I would think would be the best. And I'll say this, I think any of the Republican candidates are a whole lot better than Hillary.
Absolutely.
I do have my favorites. But that said, I look at it this way. I think what we need are thoughtful conservatives who will build a plan, who can articulate a plan, and who do it without tearing other people down. I really don't like it when conservatives start throwing rocks at each other, because when we're throwing rocks at each other, we're forgetting who the real enemy is of peace and prosperity and opportunity in this country, and that's the liberals. And so I'm often disappointed when conservatives start acting like liberals and the name-calling and the venom that they throw out at each other.
Yeah.
And so, we're conservatives. We deal with each other in a mature and professional manner, and we respect each other's opinions. We don't always agree, but what we need to figure out is what is the 80% that we agree on, and then make sure that we get that dealt with, and then find out, is there a way to come to a common understanding of the other 20%, or do you just decide, okay, we're not going to fight over that part anymore? And so that's one of the things I've seen that's happened in politics lately that I think is unfortunate. Everybody says, well, you're not 100% on this. You only voted with me 91% of the time, and so therefore mad at you because of the 9% I didn't get. That's not the way conservatives are. Conservatives are smarter than that. But, you know, it seems like that's the way it's devolved. And I'm hopeful that we can start having a more thoughtful, considerate discussion of how do we solve this country's problems without throwing rocks at each other.
Well, I'm looking forward to the campaign. It's going to be a good one. Going to be great to. I don't know. I'm sure you guys will set up a debate or something. But it's. I know it's not as fun for you as it is for all of those all people like me, the political junkies, and you know we like to get involved and know what's going on and follow the races and I love it, and of course it didn't cost me anything. It costs you a fortune every time you run, and so it's not quite the same. But hey, you know what? You're serving. You're serving the people, and I'm grateful for that. Whether everyone else feels that way, I don't know. And you know, sometimes I feel grateful, and honestly, sometimes I wonder. I wonder how long do we go? It seems like we're appeasing, like we're, you know, when can we storm? When can we hold our ground? When can we have that moment where we take control? And you know, just the frustration of. I'm not the only one who feels that way, so.
Oh no! Well, I feel the same way. I mean, trust me, I feel the same way. What I won in 2010, I went up there with these, you know, just knowing we were going to be able to stop Obamacare and stop Dodd-Frank and stop attempts at cap and trade. But unfortunately, and I think most of our constituents that elected people like me all over the country felt the same way. That we're going to stop these things, but we ran into a cold hard reality of the way our Constitution works. And our Constitution says that, you know, and for anything, whether it's appropriations and funding or whether it's any, you know, the repeal of Obamacare or whatever, you've got to have the House and Senate agree, and then you've got to have the President agree. And so we don't, no one part of government has unilateral control over any other part. And so, our founders were pretty wise in the way they developed that they wrote the Constitution. At the same time, it does cause frustrations because, you know, we'd like to go absolutely stop Obamacare, absolutely defund 100% of Obamacare. Unfortunately, you got to change the Obamacare law to defund it, and without the, you know, without full control of the Senate and without the White House, it's impossible. So,
well, they snuck it in on us.
So what you have to do is figure out. You know, how do you take off an arm off Obamacare? How do you knock one of the legs off of Obamacare? And that's what we've had to resort to, is just peeling off one part at a time. And it's starting to work. You know, you've seen 13 of the 25 co-ops fail, you know, because Obamacare was going to fail anyway, but we've accelerated its demise because it's such a bad law, and we've been able to peel it apart just a little bit of time. It's just one of these things where we thought we were going to get it done in a year or two.
I don't know what happened there. So we thought we were going to get it done in a year or two.
Yeah, and so what we're going to have to do is put the right person in the White House and make sure that we've got at least 51 Republicans in the Senate, and then we can use reconciliation for the big things like Obamacare. You can't use reconciliation for everything because you can only use it one time per budget year. But we can do those things. But you got to have the right person in the White House. You got to maintain control of the House. You got to maintain at least 51 in the Senate. You know, in a perfect world, you'd have 60 in the Senate, and that way we could do everything we wanted to do all day long. But that's not very likely to happen.
Well, I'll tell you, I appreciate you coming on. You know that it's tough to answer some of these questions, and I know your constituents. You're not gonna make everybody happy all the time, no matter what you do. So. You know, I do appreciate you coming on. So I give you the final word, and we'll wrap up our program.
Well, let me say this. First of all, Duke, I appreciate you having me on again this week. I look forward to our January show. I want to wish everybody a great 2016. I'd ask everybody to get engaged, And also, when we're getting engaged, remember that conservatives are not the enemy, that the liberals are, and that if we want to win, we've got to maintain our fight against Obama and anybody that wants to succeed him on the Democratic side of the aisle. Now, we've got to make sure that we're fighting for to maintain control of the Senate and the House. And those are the things that we need to pay attention to. Anytime we're spending our efforts fighting other conservatives, then we're not keeping our eye on what's really going to help us win. And so that's, you know, if we're going to storm the beaches, let's storm the beaches of the liberals. Let's not storm the beaches of each other.
All right. Well, that's a good final message there. I do, again, appreciate you calling in. Catch Bill Flores, Congressman Flores, every fourth Monday. And so thank you again, Congressman, for calling in. Take care. Have a good night.
You bet, Duke. I'd ask your listeners to continue to remember our country, our military, and medicine.